Welcome everyone to Spotlight, the event where we interview one of our members and talk about their fascinating lives, and today will be no exception. I want to thank Steve Pallett, who will be interviewing Polo, and you'll hear all about his book and many, many other interesting facets of Dave's life in Northern Ireland. I want to thank our recorders, Becky and Jeff. Steve, it's all yours.
Good afternoon, everybody, and once more, it's my pleasure to do a spotlight for you. Haven't done one for a little while now, but it's nice to be back doing an interview. And today, I'm going to be interviewing a relatively newcomer to For the People, I think it's pretty fair to say. And he's a little way from me. He's over our side in the United Kingdom. His name is David Calderwell, and he's in Northern Ireland. David, can I begin by thanking you for agreeing to be interviewed? And can you please tell us, first of all, where and when you were born?
Okay, Steve, you're very welcome. And first of all, may I thank all the team at FTP for giving me this opportunity. I was born in 1956 in Belfast, in one of the larger maternity hospitals of its day, called the City Hospital, and it was a wing called the Jubilee Wing in those days. It has since closed, or about to be closed, due to the cutbacks, but yeah, things must move on, I suppose, and progress takes place, and everyone's everything has moved to a larger unit now.
Now you're in Northern Ireland, which of course to us over here in the UK is very, very familiar. For the people in the States, can you give them any idea how far it is from the mainland? How far is that bit of sea between us?
By ferry crossing, you can do it in about an hour and 15 minutes. I suppose about 20 miles at the closest point, which it would be across to Scotland. If you're going up to Liverpool, well, that's a little bit longer, and it can take maybe 6-7 hours on the boat. They usually do an overnight service.
Fine, that's just to give people a little bit of perspective as to the distance. So you're a fair way across the water, you know, nice little ferry trip. Your parents, Dave, can you tell me what your parents did for a living?
My parents were working class people. My father was a bus conductor the most of his life, and then he progressed to being an inspector before he left that job and went in to work in one of the local hospitals as an orderly. My mother was, in later years she was a housekeeper for a lady who lived in a very famous house here in Northern Ireland, and I'll tell you more about that later on, Steve, but that's what she done. Nothing very spectacular, just plain working class people.
And other members of your immediate family, any brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have a sister, an older sister, who lives close by, and I had a brother who emigrated to Australia. Sadly, he died about 10 years ago. He had a terminal illness, and he didn't pull through the operation.
Oh, that's very unfortunate, Dave. It must have been a sad period in your life when that actually happened. So, you know, condolences for that. What are your earliest memories as a little boy growing up in Belfast? What are some of your early childhood memories?
Early childhood memories. The earliest memory I have, believe it or not, was being in hospital and playing with a toy rifle that someone brought me in, and it was then my school days, going to my first school. I can remember that coming up through secondary school, or primary school and secondary school. In Belfast in those days, it was quieter than what a lot of the media would make it out to be nowadays. But yeah, we had great fun. People were able to leave their front doors open in the 60s. I can remember 1966 specifically with the World Cup, and the whole area went into an uproar when England won that year.
I remember that myself. Yes, indeed, it's one of our greater claims to fame, isn't it, in the soccer world, winning the World Cup. Belfast itself, can you tell us a little bit about the area in which you grew up? What sort of a neighbourhood was it?
Yeah, it was an area. It was East Belfast. It was a working class area again, mostly terraced houses. The school that I went to was in the same street that I lived. So you know, we had plenty of opportunity, especially whenever at weekends and whatever, to go into the playground and be safe from what traffic there was around. What can I say? The people were very, very friendly in our area. There was no animosity. There was no how do I put it? None of the sort of criminal element that goes around nowadays. Everybody was helping one another. If you come across a problem, you weren't afraid to knock on your neighbour's door to go and say, "Look, could I get assistance?" Or, and in many occasions, it was the old thing was when people hadn't very much money, borrow a cup of sugar or borrow a couple of slices of bread until such times as the paycheck came round the following weekend.
Sounds very nice. Would you say that it's fair to say that it was a different way of life to what the media would portray it to be at that time? Was there lots of... Now, I don't want to get onto sensitive ground here, Dave, but was there integration in the area, or was it a segregated area in which you lived, or were you all mixed together? Because I'm sure all the people know that things haven't been always sweetness and light in Northern Ireland.
In those days, and in my early days, like growing up in Belfast, especially, it was very much mixed. Everyone got on together. There was no bigotry, or very little anyway. I can never remember any of it. Really, the first notions I had of that was probably in around the late 70s. It started creeping in, and then more and more sort of as time went on into the 80s and then the 90s. But in the 60s, when I was growing up, it was absolutely fantastic. And the religious divide, we didn't know what it was.
Yeah, and I hope it goes back that way. I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will in the fullness of time. Okay, let's come back to the young David Caldwell and take you on to your school. You said the school was in the same street, so what are your early memories of going to school? Did you enjoy your school days?
Yeah, I enjoyed my school days, Steve. Early days, primary five, I can remember winning a competition. I built the whole class had a chance to make a model. And I built a model of one of the very first oil rigs to be ever launched from Belfast. And one of my prizes was getting a trip to the zoo. And that was a big, big day out for me. I was only 10 at the time. And it was the first time I'd ever been to Belfast Zoo. After that, progressed up into secondary school. My health wasn't too good in the early days. Slightly underweight, not anorexic, but you know, underweight. I had always had problems with maybe a chest cold or whatever. So I was fortunate enough to gain the confidence of the local headmaster or the headmaster of the school. And I got the job of looking after the vending machine. So, yeah, I was fortunate enough not to have to go out a lot when I didn't want to go out into the playground. And saying that, great friends, great camaraderie in the school in those days. I wasn't any good at English. I failed my English miserably. But the practical aspects of schooling, like of metalwork, woodwork, and the sciences, I loved those and excelled to some heights in those areas.
So you were more of a practical person rather than an academic person. So you enjoyed the physical things like woodwork and metalwork and things, but the academic stuff, is it fair to say you prefer not to do?
Well, where possible, you have to, I suppose, know a certain amount of it in this day and age. But yeah, the practical stuff was my forte, and it stood by me in years to come. And I still, even though now that I have lost my eyesight, I still love tackling all sorts of DIY jobs around the house.
Yeah, we'll come on to that later. You certainly do that, Dave, in a big way. Now, you mentioned a little while ago that your mum used to work in a famous house. Now, this house is going to crop up again later in the interview. But just tell us about this house and who it actually belonged to.
Well, the house, before the people that my mother worked for bought the house from the famous author C.S. Lewis. Now, many people may recognise the name and not just know exactly who he is, but he was famous for the Tales of Narnia, and he lived in Belfast. I won't give the name of the house just at this stage, Steve, because there's new people in it yet again, and it would be probably an invasion on their privacy. But in saying that, anyone that knows C.S. Lewis will probably know the house, and if they want any more information, they just look it up in one of their search engines and look up his name, and they'll find all the information about him that they ever wish to read.
Yeah, of course he wrote The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and The Tales of Narnia and all those fantasy things, which are, you know, very, very interesting stories. So, did you actually spend a lot of time in this house? Did you go with your mum in the school holidays and things like that? Is that how you became familiar with it?
Yes, well, the people that owned it were actually from Czechoslovakia, and they started up a business here of weaving. And during the summer vacation, they always went off to places like Switzerland or Germany or over to America. So, being a large house, they didn't want it left unattended. So, maybe up to 10 weeks at a time, we moved from our home, from our entire house, and went up and stayed in this massive house. It was fantastic. Very, very fond memories of it.
Oh, goodness me. So you spent a lot of time there. Had it got extensive grounds? You know, was it totally different to your other home, your usual home?
Yeah, it was in about 2 acres of ground, Steve. Large red brick house, all totally enclosed, privately enclosed with either hedges or wooden fence. And my father, although my mother was a housekeeper, my father was a groundsman there as well. And when he was part-time groundsman, and when he couldn't do it, I also stepped in to give a hand out. And many's a time I sat on the back of a lawnmower with a seat and going around the grounds cutting the grass.
That sounds great. Well, you obviously had a really good time in those weeks and those times that you spent in the big house. As I say, we'll come back to that in a little while. After school, and Dave, after you left school, what happened then? Did you decide on a on a road to take? What was after leaving school?
Well, I mentioned earlier that my brother went to Australia. He immigrated when I was 11, so he left me his toolbox behind. And in that toolbox was a large roll of fuse wire. And I was always intrigued by things that made noise and lit up little light bulbs and stuff like that with batteries. So I was playing around with circuitry. And I'd made up my mind at an early age that I wanted to be an electrician. When I left school, I was fortunate enough to have passed the entrance exam for all three job applications, so I had a choice to make. It was either work for the local aircraft factory, which many people will know as Swart Brothers in Harland, it's now Bombardier, or owned by Bombardier, or go into the military as into the REME, Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers, or go into another company called Hugh J. Scott's. They made electrical motors. I chose, probably in hindsight, made the wrong decision. I chose Hugh J. Scott's because they had an outside contracting department, and my real forte or my real ambition was to be just a general run-of-the-mill electrician, get out there into houses, into factories, do the wiring, and have done with it. That's what I wanted to do. Unfortunately, it wasn't to be at that stage of my career, but I progressed later on and went self-employed and was able to do that anyway.
So did you start to do the apprentice electrician, or did you never actually do it at that stage? Were you an apprentice electrician?
Oh yes, very much so. I was an apprentice electrician for 4 years, and then, well, as most or a lot of big factories do, once they get the cheap labour, at the end of your 4 years apprenticeship, they sort of part company and bring in somebody else that's cheaper to employ. So I moved on. I was on the Social Security for about 6 weeks. I couldn't stand it, and I got a job driving a van around the countryside delivering fiberglass material to boat builders. Progressed from that into telecoms, putting in the telephone exchanges, and then progressed from that into the local electricity company.
So you had quite a few jobs over that few years period. Which was your favourite one out of those jobs that you'd done up until that point?
Oh, by far the last one, working for the local electricity company. It was a dream of a job to have. And I couldn't believe my luck when I went for the interview and was told about a week later that I had got the job and they wanted me to start.
And what were your duties? What did you actually do? Were you repairing cables, or were you wiring houses, or were you working on the mains supply?
A little bit of everything. We were initially on the metering end, putting meters in, going out and turning supplies on and off for people, going out doing fault finding. And then I progressed into a department which had a bit of controversy behind it, because it was commonly known as the interference department. I was going around checking up on people that were tampering with the meters and trying to get their electricity for nothing.
Oh goodness, I bet you were a welcome sight at the door then. Can you tell us any funny experiences you had that side of it? Any amusing incidents where people were trying to pretend that they weren't trying to steal the electricity?
Yeah, well, there was one very funny experience. There was an old myth going around, Steve, that if you put a £2 bag of sugar on top of your electric meter, that it made it go slower. And, well, there was an element of truth in it, but it was mostly fiction, because the £2 of sugar had no effect on the meter whatsoever. But if the meter had been loose or hadn't been secured properly to the wall, and you were able to sort of pull it forward and tip it off balance, and then the £2 of sugar would have held it off balance, and then it would have put a slight sort of had a slight effect on the momentum of the wheel that was spinning. But this wee man, one day I was in the house, and he he was all worried and he was fidgeting about as I was in the meter, and he couldn't understand why when I, before I closed the meter box door again, I put the 2 pound of sugar back on top of the meter.
Goodness me. Yeah. I bet there was all sorts of dodges to try and avoid payment, I can just imagine. So, what about your social life at this time, Dave? Because I'm sure you were away from, when you were away from work, you were out and about. What sort of things were you doing then? Because you were probably, what, by this time, early 20s?
Yeah, from I was about 18. Yeah, I was 18. 1976, I teamed up with one of my work colleagues. We built all our own disco equipment. And we went around the pubs and the clubs, and we started in the entertainment field, and had a lot of gigs on in any one week. There was some nights we had 3 gigs on in the one night, so that was sort of 3 sets of equipment, 3 DJs, all to be looked after and maintained. A couple of times I was thrown in at the deep end. I had no experience of disc jockeying. I knew the music, but like everybody else, nobody likes their own voice, and I hated my own voice, but a couple of times I was thrown in at the deep end and had to do it. Got the confidence up and, you know, progressed from there. Wouldn't say I was the world's best DJ by far, but I could pass, and, well, it lasted until about 1981, and due to the loss of my sight, I decided to hang the clogs up and pass it on to someone else.
So during this period, then you'd be working in the daytime, trying to stop people fiddling the local electricity company out of their money, and in the evenings you'd be out with your disco outfit and entertaining. Did you do weddings and things like that, people's birthdays and things like that, or were you had you got a regular venue for your disco venture?
Yeah, well, we had a few regular venues. We'd done weddings, parties, oh, you name it, outdoor gigs, we backing to groups. Our one of our big claims to fame was we actually done the backing disco to a group called Club Sound, who George Jones used to play in. I'm sure many people would know George. And but we actually we had our little business cards printed, and as you know, a bit of a joke, you know, just to make it look good, we actually advertised weddings, parties and funerals, and we actually done a disco at a funeral one time.
Oh dear, was the guest of honour there?
I'm afraid not, no, but the family seemed to enjoy it. It was his last wishes that everyone had to have a ball on him, and yeah, well, that's what they done.
Yeah. Oh well, it takes all sorts, as they say, you know. There's nothing as strange as folks. We've got a saying over here, haven't we? I don't know if you heard that one in the States, but we've got a saying which says there's no as strange as folks, which means, you know, you can't account for people's wishes. So during this period, had you met any nice young ladies? Were you going out with a girl at this time? Were you married or anything like that, Dave, from this period?
Yeah, I met my first wife in 1974, and we dated for a while. We went out together. She went to the gigs with us. She was a few years younger than me, but she looked older than me, and sometimes going in into gigs, even though I was carrying the equipment, and the questioned my age, but they never questioned her. We went everywhere together. Unfortunately, you know, through time, things didn't work out for us. But we realised that at an early stage and decided that, you know, we had a couple of kids at the time, and by this time, and it just wasn't to be. So we decided that we would part company on good terms, and to this day we're better friends now than we ever were. Better friends now than we were when we were married, and a lot of my friends and people I tell this to don't believe me. They think I'm using a terminology, an Irish terminology, they think I'm killing porkies.
Yeah, we're familiar with that one as well. In other words, lies. Porky pies rhymes with lies, just to do the translation there for the people over the other side of the pond. Now we've got to come on to a very sensitive subject for you, Dave. I respect your wishes, and I'm sure people will respect your wishes as well, and that's the area of your sight loss. Now, I know you don't want to go into this in great detail, and we respect that wish, but just say as much about it as you want to, but after this point I won't ask you any more questions about the actual circumstances of your sight loss. So, round about this period, around about 1980 I think you told me, you did lose your sight, is that correct?
Yes, Steve, it was in May 1980, and well, all I can say really, it was down to a misunderstanding of character on my part, and it was caused by trauma. I put my trust in someone that let me down badly, and as a result, I lost my eyesight. So, you know, as I say, yeah, I don't really want to dwell on it. It's in the past, it's behind me. I just went on with life. It took me a little while to adjust, but I went on with life and come out the other side. That was probably also one of the reasons that my marriage broke up, because my wife couldn't handle the stress of being, for want of a better word, saddled with someone that wasn't fully functioning.
Yeah, it's tragic, absolutely tragic circumstance to lose your sight. And as I said, we won't dwell on the exact circumstances, but would you mind answering just one or two questions about how you felt? Because you were a sighted guy, you were a fully sighted guy, a very active guy, and suddenly, I imagine very suddenly, you were blind. So how did that feel? How did that make you feel? If you can answer such a question.
In one word, devastated. But, you know, I was lying around the house feeling sorry for myself, not going out anywhere, not wanting to do anything. I was about 6 months down the line. I couldn't do a blessed thing for myself. Couldn't feed myself in the early days, and I had to get everything sort of prepared. Just for me, life was out the window. Didn't know what I was going to do. And a very close friend came in, and he's still a close friend to this day, came in and he says, "David," he says, "I need a hand." I said, "What do you want me to do?" I was very skeptical. He says, "I'm putting an engine into a car. I need a hand. Come on, get off your butt," he says. And away I went, and he had me standing on the wing of a Ford Capri. He was standing on the other wing with a rope around both our necks, tied around the engine block, and lifting the old engine out, and then in due course lowering the replacement engine back in. And that was the first thing that made me realise, yeah, well, I can do something. So we progressed from there, and we started a small car business. It wasn't very elaborate. It was just at the start a two-man show, and then progressed, and we took another partner on who you'll find out about in a few moments. And we worked at motor vehicles for about 3 or 4 years.
Can I just backtrack just slightly, David, if you don't mind, and I'll ask you, after you lost your sight and after the initial shock had worn off just a little bit, were you offered any rehabilitation at all? Was it suggested, for instance, that you should come over to maybe the mainland, to the rehabilitation place in Torquay, which is in the southwest of England? I don't know if you had any facilities over there in Northern Ireland for a similar function, but was it suggested to you by any social worker or any anyone in that field that you should think about doing that?
That actually was never an option. That never was suggested. So it wasn't. The only rehabilitation I was offered was to learn Braille or Moon. Moon was okay. It wasn't the be-all and end-all. Braille, I flattened the dots. With working at Cars, everything was getting black because of the oil was in my pores and my skin. So I gave that up as a bad job and started using audio tapes for keeping notes and whatever. Then there was a local building that was taken over by the department, and it was renamed Helen Keller House. Many people will know of Helen Keller. She was blind and deaf, and this building was named after her. I helped raise some funds for it by doing a sponsored cycle, and I was one of the first lot of people to make use of the facilities. Went in there, learned some housekeeping skills, learned to type. They tried to learn me Braille. We done a bit of relaxation therapy. But I enjoyed that, and I've been teased recently why do men not like to cook, or why do men not cook? It's not that I don't like to cook, but there's an easy option for me at the moment. So, I can cook if I put my mind to it, and I've just reenacted an old recipe that I hadn't done for many years yesterday, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. So. Yeah, learned a few skills, and they still have stood by me to this day, because typing being one of them, I now can use the computer.
Absolutely, absolutely, fine. Yeah, just curious as to whether you were offered any rehab. Wonder why, because it's very strange that you weren't offered that facility, but, you've obviously made good since, but I just find it strange that you were never offered that chance to be given help, etc. So you did mention that you and your friend set up in the motor trade, and can you just tell us a little about the sort of things you were doing with cars at that point?
General dog's body, administration, taking bookings, changing oil, lifting engines out, and I'm absolute, although I haven't had to do it for many a year, I would say with confidence that I could probably still take a 2-litre overhead cam engine out of a Ford Cortina or whatever and replace the camshaft in it without any difficulty, because I've done so many of them.
Yeah, and again, if we think back to what we said a little while ago, that when you were at school you liked the practical side of life, and here it is being used to the foremost now during that period you were servicing cars, etc. How did the customers react when they discovered that you couldn't see? Was there any ever a problem?
Not really. No, I never remember having any adverse reactions from the customers when I was working at the cars, because most of the customers were through word of mouth, through friends. It was only a small business, so we didn't sort of have a huge turnover. But I remember, I also, after I lost my sight, I still had my outside contracting business in operation. And when I turned up to help with the wiring in a house, it turned a few heads.
I can just imagine it. Yeah, I can just imagine them saying that. How do you know where the red wire goes?
Yeah, well, that's not what they were worried about, but it's a family show, Steve, so I won't repeat what was said a few times.
Okay, perhaps we'll leave that a mystery, but I think we've all got a good imagination. And again, just tracking back just a few minutes back, you said that another person came into the partnership. Who was that?
Yes, well, that was my... second wife, Kate. She came along. We actually met through CB Radio when she came along, and we met. She came into business with us. We did it. We got married for 21 years, and as you know, she passed away last year, very, very suddenly. Well, not suddenly, but unexpected. She had been ill, but no one thought she was just as ill as she was.
Did you have any children, you and Kate?
No, we didn't have any of our own. I had two to my first marriage. Kate had five to her first marriage, but no, we had none between us.
But you'd obviously got a large extended family there. Would it be too painful for you to tell us a little bit about Kate's illness? If so, just say so, but if you wouldn't mind sharing with us a little of Kate's story, because I know she's very, very prominent on your website and obviously played a very, very big part in your life for all those years.
Yeah, well, 1987 was her first problem. We were doing some work around the house and she suffered a heart attack and had to go in into a hospital. Her health picked up for quite a few years after that, and it was only about 4 years ago that things started to go downhill rapidly. She had multiple problems. She had the heart problem, she had gallstones, she had arthritis in the spine. But at the end, about a year before she died, she had to get a pacemaker fitted, and that sort of helped quite a bit. But the gallstones were the catalyst, I think, that everyone in the medical profession thought her symptoms were coming from the gallstones, and in reality, it was coming from the medication that she was taking. And her system just couldn't cope with all the toxins going into her body because she wasn't able to eat anything. Taking 21 pills every day with nothing in your stomach just can't last.
No, it must have been a really terrible time for you. I can't imagine how it must have felt and how you must have felt. So she died just about a year ago. It was a year the other day, wasn't it? I didn't know, but when we did our pre-interview chat, it just so happened that it was the anniversary of Kate's passing.
Yes, it was. Mixed emotions on that day. Joy, sadness, you know, a lot of things have happened since that. So they have, and yeah. We often talked about it because she knew she was ill for so long, and we often talked about it and what would happen if she went before I did. So, yeah, things are happening now that I think she'll be pleased with, and it's a chapter in my life that I'll not forget, but has to be left behind, and a new chapter opens, Dave.
Yeah, okay Dave, thanks very much indeed. I really do appreciate you sharing that with us. It's not easy, it's not easy. Okay, let's lighten up a little bit now and tell us about the end of the venture with the cars. Why did you have to close the business with the servicing?
It was a forced issue by the local council. The entrance to our premises was about just under a foot too narrow for what they considered to be safe for proper public access with motor vehicles. And they said you either purchase or lease the land from the person next door or close. And the person next door, it's not that he wouldn't sell us it. He was making it so uneconomical to do so. He was talking absolute telephone numbers for that little piece of strip of land that we had no option but to close.
Oh, that's terrible. I bet you were really devastated when that happened to you. Goodness me, you've had some battles. So what did you decide to do next after the motor business closed?
Done lots of things. We had a hamburger, a mobile hamburger wagon. At one stage I was in telecoms, very, very briefly, just selling reconditioned telephone handsets. Then we moved into charity work, and we done charity work for about 10 years with a local branch of a national charity called the Radio Amateur in Lydon Blind Club. So we done quite a bit of fundraising over at the side of the pond for 10 years.
Now that's interesting because you are a radio amateur. When did your interest in amateur radio begin?
1986 or 87, I think it was. I was using CB radio since 1980. What some people would refer to as the illegal bands over here, the amplitude modulation AM. Then progressed to FM, and then just again a challenge. A friend wanted to go to night class, and he said he wouldn't go unless I would go, so I went with him, and I passed an exam and he failed, and that took a lot of flack for that, so I ended up coaching him through his exam as well, and he got his ticket a couple of years later.
That's great. Can you explain to us what the RAIBC is and what it actually does for disabled radio amateurs over here?
Yeah, RAIBC stands for Radio Amateur Invalid and Blind Club, and by its name it's for invalid and blind people in the UK who can't afford to buy radio ham equipment for themselves. We would have raised funds, we would have purchased the equipment and give it out on permanent loan. It always belonged to the club, it never belonged to the individual, but they had it for as long as they wanted to use it. We maintained that equipment, we erected antennas, we set up home tuition courses, all sorts of things, anything at all. There was anything within the hobby that was deemed necessary to get a blind or disabled person behind a microphone or behind a shortwave radio, we took it on board.
And you worked, were you on the fundraising side of this?
Again, fundraising, general dog's body, everything started off with the fundraising. Progressed up through treasurer to chairman, and then, as I say, after 10 years, because of my wife's ill health, we decided, well, enough was enough. Someone else could take over the reins, and we pass it on. And it's still going today over here, not on as big a scale, but it is still ticking over and holding its own.
Fine. And this was purely voluntary work, was it? Was it a paid job, or was it just, you know, Davey doing his turn for the amateur radio community?
Purely voluntary. The only thing that we got was our expenses, i.e., our mileage expenses, or if you had to buy postage stamps or stationery, but there was no paid positions in the charity anywhere, even in the UK, there's no paid positions.
Now, Davey, you're famous on For the People for one or two reasons, and the main reason really is the book you've written. You've written a thriller. Now, when did you decide to write a book?
It was by sheer chance that the book has come out, or coincidence, whatever you like to call it. It was about 6 years ago, maybe slightly more, and I was sitting having a drink with a friend, and he was talking about a story that he had in his head about his granny and his auntie and his uncle and whatever, and he wanted to put it down on paper. And he says, yeah, it's funny you should say that. I have a story in my head that I would love to tell, but it's not about my granny. And I said, basically said, yeah, I'll maybe do it someday or do it. And that was it. There was nothing more said about it for a few weeks until I overheard another guy talking. I wasn't supposed to overhear the conversation, but I overheard it. And it basically was saying, David Caldwell, he'd never do that. Sure, he couldn't spell to save his name. He was no good at English at school or anything like that. So that was like a red flag to a bull. I says, is that right? And I give myself a challenge that should it take me a lifetime, I would do it. It took me about 3.5-4 years to get the final draft done on the computer, and we're reading through it one day, and Kate says to me, he says, you know, wouldn't it be great if that was read in a human voice instead of with that stupid computer voice? And he says, yeah, but who am I going to get to do it? So, a few adverts went out, nobody local came across. There was a caption at the bottom of my email, and in came a reply from a friend in Birmingham, Alabama. He said, yeah, I think my husband could do that. So we talked, I sent back a draft of the prologue. The tape came back, and as soon as we heard it, we said, yeah, that's the voice I want. What Kate agreed wholeheartedly. She fell in love with the voice too. So that's how it came about. It was only 6 months down the line, or halfway through the reading of the manuscript, that we found out that the chap that was reading it, his name is Ken Osborne, was actually totally blind himself, and he was reading it, listening to a set of headphones, presumably with JAWS or Window Eyes or something like that. I never got asking him what screen reader he used, but he was listening through headphones and talking into a live mic at the same time.
Goodness me, that's incredible. That's absolutely fantastic. So, can we just backtrack just a little bit, Dave? So, can you explain to us the physical process of you actually writing the book? Did you sit down at the computer and write it down on the keyboard as a Word document? Is that how you did it?
When it first was started, at its first conception, it was an old 486 DOS machine in WordPerfect 5.1. Done it in little bits, little chapters, and the heading of each chapter, all the character names was sort of put in as notes, place names, times, dates, birth, you know, all the relevant little bits of information as memos for the characters. And you just go through, you build up a story, and you're back and forward from one chapter to another, and backtracking, adding little bits in. And I suppose it maybe went through about 6 or 7 rewrites. I lost track, you know, to be honest, and I eventually ended up with what I thought was an excellent piece of work. It was recorded. The recordings were, the actual audio, the first audio was about 40 hours in length. When it came back to me, and I had to cut that down quite a bit, so I managed to actually edit the audio version down to just under 32 hours.
Yeah, so it had to have quite a bit of editing. Now, I've never spoken to an author before, and I'm curious to know, have you always had a fertile imagination? Were you always good at making up stories in your head, or was it a completely new idea which just suddenly came to you because of that conversation?
It was a totally new idea. I had never a notion of it, so I hadn't. But it's like all stories, it's like all fiction. It's always based on an element of truth. There has to have something, or there has to be something there in your head to trigger that thought. So yeah, there's, I would say 90% of the things that I have written in the book Secrets That We Keep actually happened to either myself or some of my friends or someone that I have heard of. Some of it is poetic license, you know, you dress it up and switch things around and whatever. All the names obviously have been changed to protect anyone that is innocent, for want of a better terminology. But yeah, it was a totally new experience and something I'd never ever tackled before.
Did you find that you had any difficulty remembering the plot, remembering characters and what they did and where they were and what they said and so on as the book progressed? Did you find yourself thinking, did so-and-so do that in chapter 3, or am I wrong? I mean, in other words, was it difficult to keep track of the characters and the plot?
At the start, yeah, it took a little bit of thinking that, you know, what chapter did I say that in? Did I actually say that? How did I say it? And you maybe had to make it fit in with the bit that you were presently writing, you had to go back and maybe change a few words, but it just became natural that you remembered everything that you had said in previous chapters. Lots of red herrings as well, mind you. There's lots of little bits in there that would maybe lead you to believe that something else is going to happen when it actually doesn't. It turns out totally opposite than what you may think.
I can imagine it'd be pretty difficult to keep track of, but you obviously managed it. Now, I'd never in a million years dream of asking you to give away the story, but for people who don't know, can you give us a rough outline of the story? You probably whet a few people's appetite, because you've certainly whetted mine.
Yeah, well, it's a twin track story. There's an undercover agent working for a very high profile government department that comes into it. Thus the caption, she's actually very, very prominent. Thus the caption, she stalks, she seduces, she kills, because she's a very, very feisty woman. You know, she knows what she wants, she goes out there and she gets it, she takes no nonsense. But the other characters, one's a disc jockey, who's a renowned playboy, and he marries a millionairess, and this is where the house comes in, that C.S. Lewis used to own, because I used the house as the main dwelling for the story.
Okay, so that's just a little flavour of what it's about, and you have got a website, and I'll ask you to give us the website address before the end of the interview, and people can go and have a little look around your website. It's a very interesting website you have, Dave. Have you got plans to get this book in print, in hardback, because it's available on CD at the present time, I believe, but have you got plans to have it actually published in hardback?
Yeah, that's my eventual aim. I don't know when it will be. I had an offer about a year ago from an Australian publisher, but he was looking absolute telephone numbers. He wanted all the money up front. He wasn't prepared to take any risks, so I've since found that that's not the way to go. So I got it produced locally in audio, because the readings that Ken done were so professional sounding that it was a shame not to use them. And I hope to use part of the sales, part of the profit from the sales, to put it into paperback, and another part to help set up a fund, or start off a fund to help purchase some electronic aids for disabled people or blind people here in Northern Ireland. But that's another story for another day, yeah, Steve. Audio, it's available straight MP3 on one CD, or the new Daisy format for anyone that has access to the new Daisy players, the Victor readers or whatever. I know most of the people in the UK do have them from the RNIB, and Canada are now changing over to Daisy players, so it will become a thing of the future for most people that want to read audiobooks. And for anyone that hasn't read an audiobook before, that may be said, it's, well, vision impaired people can tell them it's a totally new experience.
It certainly is. It brings a whole new dimension to it, and I think sighted people enjoy it. I think that's the popularity of books on cassette here, that people play in their cars. You know, they I think most people as children had stories read to them, and I think secretly lots of sighted people still get that pleasure from being read to, and you know, there's no reason why a sighted person shouldn't buy your book and really, really get into it on a flight or something like that. It would be a fantastic thing to listen to while you're just sitting there. Have you got any plans to write any more novels? Do you think there's another novel in there waiting to come out?
There's another one, three quarters finished. Same characters, different plot, 20 years later. some people would call it a sequel, but I want to get this one up and really, really on the go before I get back into the sequel. I also do write a few poems, a lot of very, very sentimental stuff, mostly. I've a few ideas in my head. New words to old songs. I'm not musical in the slightest, so the only way I can sort of write songs is to get a tune in my head of an old song and strip all the wording out of it and then rewrite it to the same tempo. So I've done that a few times as well.
You know, we're talking about poems. There's a really beautiful tribute to Kate on your website, which I assume is read by Ken, the guy that reads your book, and I would recommend anyone to go and listen to that tribute to your wife, because it's a really, really beautiful piece of work. Would you like to just give us the website so that people can take a look afterwards and learn how to order the book, etc.? Just give us the URL, will you?
Yeah, the website for the book is all lowercase, www.secretsthatwekeep.com, just spelt as you would normally spell the word secrets that we keep. And there's little audio clips there, sections taken from the book. There's an audio commercial on there as well. It's under the I think it's under the tag "Listen to the Trailer." So it was recorded by Ken as well, with some very sort of heartbeaty music and whatnot in behind it. So yeah, anyone wants to go along, they're most welcome. The poetry, well, there's a small page up there just for a bit of fun. It would be, if anyone wants links to any of my web pages, they can get it behind the link kittyd.me.uk. So if you can't remember any of the other pages, there'll be a simple link there to take you through to the poetry page or some jokes or find out a little bit more about me, see my home, some pictures of places that we've been. If you've got any vision at all, you can have a look at some photographs or whatever. It's all there, and it's all readily available.
Okay, Dave, thanks very much. So that's secretsthatwekeep.com, www.secretsthatwekeep.com is the place to find out about the book, and I'm sure people will be curious to go and have a look and buy it. I'm going to buy a copy. I want to hear what happens now. For the people who's become very important to you in the last few months, I do know that, and we've got an example of one of your poems that you wrote, and I think Calvin Shea is going to play it in for us in a second. I'll give you a few seconds to get yourself ready, Calvin, but in a minute we're going to hear a little poem Dave wrote about For the People, which I know Jennifer's played on her Hearts and Heroes program one or two times. I've actually heard it on there, and I think it would be nice for people to hear how you feel about For the People. So I'll de-key, and hopefully you'll hear the poem, and then I'll come back and ask you a little bit about your involvement with For the People. So here's David's poem.
Hi, this is Dave in Northern Ireland, and I'd just like to share a poem that I've wrote especially for the people. F is for friendship with the people I meet. I open a room where we all come to greet. O is for others like you and like me, who do what we can despite we can't see. R is for romance that may come our way. We all want to have it. It should happen someday. T is the truth we share with our friends, in good times and sorrow, some ears we may bend. H is the hope we surely must have, that things will get better and never be bad. E is excitement for the people we know, when things turn out good and new friendships they grow. P is for people, both like me and like you, we all share our stories and tell some that's new. E is forever, which I hope you all think. Our friendships will last and never will sink. O is a hug, you may need it sometime. It may come with a kiss that may even be mine. P is the pleasure I get from the sight when talking to people, both by day and by night. L is for love that most people do share. I know when I need it, there'll be someone out there. E is forever, and I hope you agree. FTP will be there, both for you and for me. I won't put the words to .com at this time. I'll just say good luck with best wishes in mind. But if you see me around, please do say hello. I'm the mint with the hole. That's a polo, you know.
Thanks very much, Calvin, for playing that. That's really, really good, Dave. Really, really nice sentiments, which I'm sure we can all agree with. We all feel very much like that about For the People. Tell us how you got involved in For the People. How did you first hear about it?
Oh, I'm afraid it was one of your other members. It goes by the name of TaylorMade. He talked me into joining up. And, all I can say is to Oren, thank you, Oren, because it has really made a change in my life, especially the FTP singles list. It's no big secret that I've met someone that's very special to me at the moment, so... only for FTP singles, you never know. I could still be sitting here thinking of what's going to happen next.
Are you going to tell us who?
I think she may be listening and getting a red face now, but... Well, okay. If Peaches wants to come in and say hello at the end, she may wish to stay silent, but yeah, Peaches and myself are... good friends at this moment in time, and it's good that we met up.
That's lovely. Yeah, I've spoken to Peaches quite a few times, and it's always a great pleasure talking to her, and we had this conversation about English pantomime, because I know she's involved in acting and dramatics and stuff over there, and we were talking about English pantomime one day, and yes, indeed, we all wish you all the very, very the best of luck in the future. We're drawing towards the end now, Dave, and I'm going to ask you this question. It's a serious one, and then I'll be a bit flippant at the end. But what would you say at this point in your life has been your greatest achievement so far?
Oh, my greatest achievement? Probably learning computing skills would be my greatest achievement in recent years anyway, because I never ever thought that it would be possible. I remember way back when the first Spectrums came out, and there was a silly little synthesizer came with it, and I tried it and I said, yeah, I never managed that, and threw it to one side, never thought much about it until we got onto the Dolphin products with Hal, and that really made me want to learn something and to progress. So yeah, computing I think would be the biggest achievement, the biggest single achievement that I have ever had.
That's fine. And what about ambitions? What's your ambitions for the future? Where would you like to see your life going from this point on?
From this point on, the ambitions, the main one would be, I suppose, to settle down, be happy, travel the world, you know, who knows. A lot of people would say money is a great thing, but money to me doesn't matter as long as you have enough to get by on, and you're not struggling, enough to have those life's little luxuries without sort of going over the top.
Okay, that's absolutely fine. Okay, I'm going to spring this on you now, Dave. I do this to most of the interviewees that I have. I'm going to give you very little thinking time, in fact, no thinking time. I want very quick answers to some very silly questions, okay? What's your favourite season?
Summertime.
And what's your favourite time of day?
Midday.
Favourite types of music?
Oh, well, yeah, I have to rephrase this because my favourite type of music, I used to call it disco, but I've been told off for that. 70s disco music.
Okay. And your favourite way of relaxing?
Oh, just chilling out in the garden with maybe a long, cool drink. Maybe the odd Bacardi and Coke or something like that. Or maybe a nice, calm walk along the beach.
Sounds good to me, because of course you're not too far from the sea where you are. Well, I'd like to thank you very much indeed, Dave, for agreeing to be interviewed, and thank you for sharing some very painful periods in your life. It can't have been easy sitting there telling us your feelings at certain periods of your life. Thank you very much indeed for agreeing to be interviewed. We usually open the floor to questions, so if anyone would like to ask you any questions, if you'd be willing to take questions from the floor. Thanks again, and it's been a real pleasure interviewing you, and I don't really know you until the other day. We'd never spoken, funnily enough, although we're both on the peaks quite a bit. We'd never met until the other day, and I feel that I know you very, very well now, and it's a great pleasure to know you, Dave, and thanks a million.
Yes, Gabe, you're very welcome, and I can give about 10 minutes here of a colleague waiting on me at the moment to go round. I've promised to help him move some furniture. He's moving house over the next few days, but I can give 10 minutes if anyone wants to fire any questions.
Okay, any questions for Dave?
Hey Dave, this is Hallie. I just want to say you did a very good, it was a very good interview, and I enjoyed it very much, and Steve, you did a good job also.
Yeah, and I personally have ordered Dave's book. Hopefully it'll be here next week. I encourage everyone to support him and any other authors on our site here. It's a heck of an achievement, in my opinion.
Okay, you're all very welcome. And once again, it's been a pleasure being able to do this. And I must thank all the staff, the technicians, whoever the organizers of FDP, for providing such a wonderful facility. Long may it last.
Dave's poem set to music and a link to his site will be on the posted somewheres under Galaxy of Stars in the next week or two, and I want to thank Shay for setting that to such beautiful and appropriate music. Steve Powell, it's wonderful to have you back. Great interview. Both of you did a great job. Thanks.
That's a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Okay, Steve, if you don't mind, I had better go here because time is of an essence, and if anyone wants at any time, if they see me in any rooms and they think of any questions that they don't want to come in now and ask, just pop in and ask me, you know. I'll be only too glad to speak to anyone. But for now, it's farewell from Northern Ireland, and we'll talk to you all soon. Okay, good night.
Great job, gentlemen.
Thanks, Dave. It's a really great interview. It's a great pleasure doing it for you, and see you around.
Good job, guys, and the poem is very, very true, every word of it.
Yeah, real nice poem he did for us there. And I want to thank our recorders. Thank you very much, Jeff and Becky. Steve will be interviewing someone else again 2 weeks from today, and we'll of course get the word out who that lucky person will be. Again, Steve, thanks. You're the best of the best.